Hello, I'm Laura McAllister. I'm a professor at Cardiff University and currently a vice president of UEFA as well. I'm also a fellow at the Institute of Welsh Affairs, and in my opinion, it's never been more important to talk openly about Wales's future and how we can address the opportunities and challenges ahead. To do this, we need places like the IWA, but they also need our support to continue their work, especially to encourage discussions for Wales's future to help come up with the solutions that we really need. So if you can do it and believe in the work of the IWA, I'd really urge you to become a member or make a donation. Diolch yn fawr iawn.
Shamai, welcome back to the IWA's podcast series, Wales, a Work in Progress, which seeks to examine and inform the ongoing debate around Wales's constitutional and democratic future. The IWA's ongoing policy project on Wales's constitutional future is supported by the Legal Education Foundation, and I'm Joe Rossiter, co-director of the IWA, and I manage the project. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Steph Coulter, who'll be discussing the Institute for Government and the Bennett Institute for Public Policy's review of the UK Constitution Project, which late last year produced their final report, which represented 18 months investigation into the overwhelmingly large subject of the UK's Constitution. And Steph is a research assistant at the Bennett Institute for Public Policy and was co-author of the review of the UK Constitution Project. So the perfect person to dive into some of the report's themes and recommendations with. Croeso, welcome, Steph.
All right, thanks for having me, Joe.
No problem. Now, can you tell me, broadly speaking, about the review of the UK Constitution Project?
Yeah, so the project emerged from like in a single word answer in Brexit, and probably going to want a few more words about exactly why we decided to do this and why we chose to do it at that particular point in early 2022 when it began. And essentially, as was well observed and kind of across think tanks and the academy and media, that the UK's constitution had come under severe strain during the Brexit process. And we kind of identified that it came under strain across three axes. That was an institutional strain in between relations between government, parliament and the courts. There was territorial tensions between central government and the devolved nations of the UK. And then there was also a kind of democratic tension between the people and the state. And the report in early 2022, this stuff was to some extent receding into the rearview mirror, and it's quite a good time to take stock and think about what we learned from this, what the problems were, and where the next steps were going to be. So that was where it came from.
Yeah, well, I think that's that experience will resonate quite strongly in Wales with the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales, and that certainly seeing Brexit as a moment where constitutional boundaries were kind of stretched, weren't they, and which led to some more fundamental questions here in Wales but also across the UK. So why was there a need for the UK constitutional review? You've seen that stretching of some of the boundaries, but why was it needed now, and how broadly did you conceive of it beyond Brexit as well?
Yeah, I think that there was kind of two overarching things that we thought that we were aiming to achieve with it. And the first thing was not necessarily policy related, but we did have a desire to kind of perform a convening function. So we wanted to have this big, open, cross-party and indeed multinational conversation about the state of the constitution. And we wanted to try to bring people together who'd been sort of at odds with one another, to put it mildly, over the past few years. And I think that was one of the great successes of it, was to try and, bring together people from different political parties in different parts of the UK. And we're very careful to make sure that we're accounting for all different opinions and different perspectives on the constitution. So that was one part of it. And the second part of it was, yes, as you kind of alluded to, the Brexit process exposed some weaknesses in the UK's constitutional arrangements. One of the key observations from our research was that the weaknesses in the system of checks and balances in the constitution. That another problem was that we don't really have a clear perception of what's constitutional and what's not. There's not this clear demarcation between constitutional policy and the process for constitutional change and just any other policy, which we think, for various reasons, we think that's a problem. And then also, and this is something that I'm sure you come across a lot, and I'm sure it's a big feature during the research and independent commission, is that there's not a lot of clarity about what is constitutional in the British context, or indeed the kind of Welsh or the Scottish or the Northern Irish context. And I think some more clarity amongst the public, but also amongst the media and parliament, would be desirable. So those were the key problems, and we wanted to try and come up with some innovative solutions to these, that some stuff that perhaps people hadn't purported much before. So we didn't want to do the whole rehash the debates about written constitution and whatnot, because that's quite old ground, but can speak about that more if need be.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting what you say around, you know, convening what is a really political conversation, where especially from the experience of Wales, of having trying to have a cross-party kind of conversation on things that are inherently political and with people's differences, especially across the UK, but also, you know, in different parts of the UK, of what the constitutional future of the UK and Wales looks like, because these questions are inherently political. They're about how you see the best way for a nation to be governed. And I think that came across in the work that's happening in Wales, and also in your work as well. So if I could look at some of the recommendations that you've made, some really interesting set of recommendations, you know, I think it's important for us in Wales, I think, to hear, we can suggest what's happening in Wales and have a really important conversation in Wales, but ultimately lots of the means through which constitutional change happen at a UK level. Therefore, there is inherently a need at the moment and into the future for people in Wales to understand, you know, how constitutional change happens in a UK context, because that's the means through which you can achieve constitutional change across the UK, but also understanding the nitty-gritty of how it gets changed, because, you know, there's multiple different parties in Wales that want to see change to that. So hence why, you know, we've brought you in to talk about some of these recommendations. One of the really interesting ones up front is you propose a parliamentary committee on the constitution. Can you talk to me about what this would look like, what it would be, what its remit is, and also critically, how would it seek to engage with other parliaments and governments and committees that might be, you know, in the Senate, for example, as well, so that you can hear that perspective, like systemically, not just in terms of interparliamentary relations, which are very poor, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Parliamentary Committee on the Constitution was, yeah, one of us there picked three key recommendations alongside the establishment of a category of constitutional acts, and then also some recommendations relating to greater citizens' involvement in the process of constitutional change. So the idea behind this was to have a central watchdog, or a central, one of the phrases we used, and we produced a paper on constitutional guardians. We wanted a kind of central guardian that could act as one kind of prominent legal scholar referred to as a reason demanding body, something that could hold the government to account. And part of the problem is, in the existing ecosystem in the UK Parliament, we have two influential committees doing this in either house. And the idea was kind of to combine them to make a super committee that would benefit from the expertise of members from the House of Lords and the political legitimacy from members of the House of Commons. And we have this in the Joint Committee on Human Rights, which is a very effective and influential body as a result of its Joint Committee status. And we kind of wanted to mirror that for constitutional policy, not just human rights policy. And it could potentially have new powers. So some of the new powers we suggested was directly tabling amendments in the name of the chair, being able to request a scrutiny delay to legislation that the committee felt was warrants particular scrutiny as a result of the sort of scale and nature of the constitutional changes it proposes, and been able to refer a non-legislative issue to a vote on the floor of the House. So there's different kind of extra powers that such a committee could feasibly have. And I should say that this committee was influenced by some comparative work that we've done on Finland, where there's a very influential constitutional committee that doesn't necessarily have hard power, but has a lot of soft power and influence in how the government of the day approaches constitutional policy. And that we saw similarities between the Finnish model of constitutional politics, in which the courts don't have a huge role in kind of striking down legislation, and our model here in the United Kingdom. So that was where it emerged from. But yeah,
well, I think it's interesting that you say, you know, in terms of we see it in the Senate, we see it in Parliament as well, that committees are one of the few places where meaningful cross-party collaboration and in-depth scrutiny, that is the result of, you know, expertise and interest in a specific set of issues, can actually happen. So, you know, I was just pleased to see that the committee system, you know, and ensuring that almost a super-powered committee as a key mechanism for change seems pretty sensible to me, especially when, like you say, it needs to be kind of procedural as well as political in that way. And the committees are that place, aren't they, where that deliberation is cross-party, can take place. Certainly seen that in the Senate, and I'd be interested to see, considering, you know, how broad recommendations the Independent Commission in Wales has made on constitutional reform, how that could work in a Senate context, which is completely out of scope of the paper, but I think it'll be interesting for Welsh listeners to think, you know, we're going to have an enlarged Senedd. We have typically special purpose committees for areas of reform, but actually having something that is, you know, is not a special purpose committee, it is long standing, and it will continually scrutinise different elements that are within the remit of, you know, constitutional issues as wide as you define them, seems, you know, a way of ensuring that constitutional issues are taken, you know, have that opportunity to have a broader and lengthier moment of scrutiny when it comes to constitutional issues that trickle down into all areas of government, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think establishing these things is always a lot of their ability to influence policy will come from that cross-party working, that if people perceive the committee to be biased or fractured, and then that would dilute the ability of it to make incisive recommendations on constitutional policy. But one thing we tend to see in the UK Parliament is, and this is something that we observe from our debates with people across different parties, that on these issues of constitutional principle that go beyond kind of social policy or the politics of redistribution, we see parliamentarians, and in the UK context, the best example of this is the House of Lords Constitution Committee, which has got people from all across the political spectrum, but they managed to come together and have quite principled debates on constitutional policy and make recommendations based on those principles. And that's something, as you alluded to earlier, constitutions are always going to be, constitutional policy is inherently political. But I think that all of us would desire, and this is something that the Independent Commission, I think, was very, very clear in the final report, was try to ground its recommendations not in a kind of certain vision of party politics, but and constitutional principles about what democracy in Wales should look like. So I think committees can be important in that regard. But then also, you rightly point out that one of the problems that we, one of the challenges raised to us by people, stakeholders who we engaged with in the devolved context, was, well, would this new super committee just be another way of crudely for Westminster to kind of bash the devolved governments? And this was something that was raised to us by someone, a Scottish independence supporter, who was a key stakeholder for us throughout. And this was something we had to internalise, because we can see that the optics perhaps aren't great. And the two things I would say on kind of wheeling back to your question about how to ensure that this is a all-nation body. The first is that I'd say that Westminster committees tend to be a lot more nuanced in their approach to devolution and territorial issues than recent governments perhaps have been. So I think any suggestion that it would be a kind of lapdog of government is probably misreading exactly how the committee system works. But then there's also the Welsh Affairs Select Committee has the guesting function, which we saw as quite a good precedent that you could very feasibly have members from the devolved parliaments sit in on this committee, or you could have kind of chairs of relevant committees, constitutional committees across the devolved parliaments sit in on this. So there's a way to kind of foster more interparliamentary work, which, as you'd notice, is quite weak and very nascent at the moment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if this is a model that would work, then I wouldn't see either, you know, from a Welsh perspective, senators looking at that and thinking, oh, well, actually, this seems to be a way of pushing forward multiple areas that need improvement on a cross-party basis. Which brings in onto the next plank of some of your recommendations is creating this new category of constitutional acts that recognises the importance of key pieces of legislation that underpin the political system. Can you talk me through that as a recommendation as well?
Yeah, this is perhaps our most complex recommendation. So try and do it justice without going on for 10 minutes about it. But as I alluded to earlier, our current system doesn't make an effective distinction between constitutional and non-constitutional policy. And there is a distinction. There's some procedural mechanisms in Parliament that says that bills are first-class constitutional importance go to a committee of the whole House, but first-class constitutional importance is fairly ill-defined, and the whole system doesn't seem to be effective in building in a kind of, and I don't want, to, this is maybe a bit hyperbolic, but a reverence for constitutional issues, that this is about the democratic fabric of the state and isn't just something that should be reduced to party political manoeuvring, as it were. So that was the principle behind the establishment of legislation that is considered constitutional statutes. And key pieces of legislation could be identified as constitutional, fairly uncontroversially. I would say the devolution statute, the Human Rights Act, Parliament Acts, stuff like that, and others have created lists of kind of constitutional statutes that could act as a starting point, and these could be given extra protection. So some of the things that we identified was that they should not be subject to implied repeal or secondary legislation, and that they could be subject to minimum timescales. So any amendment or repeal of this legislation was a more elongated and considered process. And then one of the big recommendations is that there should be a whole new process of parliamentary scrutiny for constitutional legislation that involved a lot of pre-legislative scrutiny. And this is something that there's a big overlap here, because this is essentially parliamentary entrenchment. And some of the more controversial elements of that we explored was you could have a referendum lock on certain pieces of legislation, which of course exists for the devolution statutes, and more, and this isn't something we recommend, but something we explored, you could have manner and form stuff, so super majorities and whatnot.
Which we have in Wales. We reached just a couple of weeks ago, as we record, the Senedd members an elections bill passed, and obviously because it was about the quite broad reforms to the Senedd as a body, had to have a supermajority, which is of 40 of 60, so 2/3. So I guess people in Wales will be familiar of that, categorising a certain type of legislation as, you know, is regarding more scrutiny and more broadly support across a parliament than other pieces of legislation potentially, which is really interesting. In terms of the public engagement, I guess is the third plank of some of the recommendations of this report. Really interesting in that direct crossover to what some of the Independent Commission in Wales has been talking about in terms of the fact that in the cases even more so in Wales, where you could say democracy at a Welsh level is is in perhaps poorer health than the rest of the UK, is if you were to look at that quite blunt metric of election turnout for Welsh elections in Wales. And that was really clearly came across in terms of the Independent Commission's report, in terms of this democratic malaise in Wales. But as you say, it's a much broader issue in a UK context as well. So not only a Wales issue. In terms of your recommendation, you speak about how public engagement should be integrated into the process of constitutional change to enhance the legitimacy of decision making and provide a degree of political entrenchment. Can you talk us through some of the some of your recommendations here? You've identified public engagement as maybe in constitutional matters as a kind of issue that speaks to damaging their legitimacy. How have you kind of tried to cross that bridge with your recommendations?
Yeah, I think it's quite zeitgeisty at the moment, the public engagement stuff, and rightly so. And there's obviously been a lot of media coverage because of the suggestion in the biography, sorry, of Keir Starmer that. From Sue Gray, that citizens' assembly and more direct democracy will be a part of Labour's platform should they win power. And this is, it goes without saying that this is anathema to a lot of people who are more conservative, small c conservative, in their approach to constitutional issues. And that constitutional kind of that small c conservatism actually straddles both political parties in different ways. It's not solely the preserve of the Conservative Party. But we feel that this, the democratic disillusionment that you allude to at both the Welsh and the UK context is something that citizens' engagement can contribute to. And we've seen lots of examples of international best practice of how citizens' engagement exercises can be used to unlock tricky issues and provide a roadmap for parliaments who are divided over these quite big, as I say, principled issues of the democratic fabric of the country. And one of the big things we emphasise is that there's so many different ways in which these innovations can be deployed in the constitutional policy life cycle, as it were. So you could start with a citizens' assembly to outline kind of broad principles for constitutional reform, or you could start, say, something like House of Lords reform that's struggled to get through Parliament on several occasions since 1997. You could start with the citizens and find out what they want, and then that would presumably kind of lubricate that process through Parliament. Or you could involve citizens in different ways, like citizens' juries to scrutinise legislation, which we've seen in Scotland. You could also use, if there was a referendum on a constitutional wedge issue or another big issue at the national level, citizens could be brought in to deliberate over information and produce a kind of handout that could be a formal, impartial piece of information for people to digest prior to the referendum and whatnot. So there's different models that we can use for this, but governments need to be clear about how they're using citizens' engagement exercises, and also need to be very, very clear that when using these innovations, that they need to take into account, and it seems self-evident, but they need to take into account and trust what people say. That happened in France, where there was a citizens' engagement exercise on climate change issues, and none of the recommendations were taken forward, and that thing can be really, that can have the opposite effect of further disillusionment.
Yeah, I think this is definitely something we're looking at the IWA as well. We're looking at doing a report later in the year, talking to some of that. You know, it's well established now that these are mechanisms, and as you say, they're especially important when it comes to those keystone constitutional principles. But they're also important for other issues. But in terms of when you're talking about you know, the mechanisms are really important about how you do these practices, and how if you put junk in, you get junk out in citizens engagement. You know, it can't be self-selecting. It needs to be done through a sortition-like process. So it was interesting to read about some of the, you know, the intricacies of that, about, well, maybe bodies like the Senedd or Welsh Government should, you know, these should be publicly funded, some of these citizens engagement processes, because otherwise you get into difficulty about transparency of funding. So definitely something that we're looking at in the IWA later in the year, in terms of how you actually mainstream some of these public engagement exercises into, you know, the bloodstream of your economy to improve democratic health over a longer term, rather than necessarily just for constitutional issues. But constitutional issues are clearly right up there in terms of what you would want those kind of engagement processes to look like as well. So definitely of interest to the IWA and Wales as well.
Exactly. Just on the cost thing, is because that's one of the big roadblocks we see, that these things can cost a lot of money. But actually, when you look at this, we've got a bit on pricing and cost in the report, and we just need to think about also the cost of bad policy, or the overarching cost of people feeling like they're not involved, people not feeling like, yeah, I suppose the dichotomy that I would make on it is people feeling like they're simply an electorate and not citizens, and that this process can be really, really empowering for people, and that's hard to put a price on as well.
And the investment in democracy is important as well. We've had this in Wales regarding, you know, Senedd reform, and at a time when budgets in Wales are really constrained, public budgets in Wales are really constrained, making the case for 30 more politicians is quite a difficult sell. But, you know, the argument of making sure that body is able to deal with its increasing workload and is future-proof for potentially further workload is a really important thing to make sure that the Senedd continues to function with the increased workload it's got. So I wanted to zoom back out as well into some of this. You've got a review coming up in the future, a bit more current piece of work around the process of triggering independence referendums. Obviously, historically, been much more prominent political issue in Scotland. But you've got a piece of work looking at this, and obviously there's political issues around Scotland's ability to grant an independence referendum when powers for that, you know, you need to UK government needs to grant that. So could you talk to me a bit about that? Might be interesting, given that the Independent Commission, obviously in Wales, had three visions for the long-term constitutional future of Wales, one of which was independence. So yes, would be interested to hear what that work looks like as well.
Yeah, should caveat by saying that this isn't formally associated with the review or the Institute for Government. Yeah. This is a Bennett Institute piece of work. Just for, so there's no confusion. And yes, this is something, a paper that's going to be coming out in Political Quarterly towards the end of the summer. And it focuses largely on, as you say, the Scottish context, because it's seen as kind of more urgent question in Scotland, given the high level of support for independence. And it deals with this, it uses kind of comparative methods and looks at Canada, where there's a Clarity Act was passed in 2000 that ostensibly provided clarity on when and how, not necessarily when and how, but the thresholds by which a future Quebec independence referendum would be seen as legitimate and could initiate that process of secession. And a lot of people in British public policy circles have kind of proffered this as a model. So we looked at the value and efficacy of this model in the Scottish context. And we think there's actually a strong case for constitutionalising secession, as it were. If you look at kind of precedent, it's already fairly clear that the union is voluntary. There's legislation that says as much, the Good Friday Agreement, not legislation, an international agreement that says as much in the context of Northern Ireland. And the precedent has been established with the the 2014 independence referendum. But what we have is we have a lack of clarity about who has the right to call a referendum and when. And we propose either a piece of legislation or an intergovernmental agreement. In this instance, between Scotland and the UK government. But we also say in the conclusion that this could feasibly and fairly reasonably be applied to Wales as well. And that some kind of agreement would provide those who want independence with the much kind of wanted legal route to secession, whilst also, we believe, creating greater constitutional stability by putting procedures in place, which is also controversial. I'm sure it'll annoy people on both sides, which is we're fully expecting. But that would be an interesting constitutional innovation, which would especially account for the fact that looking at demographic voter trends in Scotland in particular, the independence, the support for independence looks unlikely to go away in the future, even if the SNP are struggling politically right now.
Yeah, and similar issues in Wales as well around that kind of demographic split as well, not necessarily party political in Wales inherently either. It links into that other question, which I'll leave as a final question, in terms of, you know, clarity around the constitutional setup of the UK and the way that it functions. We've seen in Wales and in Scotland, both sides, UK and devolved nations, trying to push the line of what is in within devolved competency and what's reserved. You know, gender reform bill being one of them. Welsh government saying that they would look to, go down a similar route. Obviously, brings in the Supreme Court, and I think people look at that and say, the fact that these constitutional issues, that a lot of parliamentary time in a devolved nation is taken over a piece of legislation, but then it's resolved in a court, feels like something's going wrong here. There's a lack of clarity and a lack of engagement between governments around what the constitution looks like and who is meant to be doing what. So you've made a couple of recommendations there, but just broadly wanted you to speak on that clarity about the constitutional position of the UK. You've spoken about how there needs to be some constitutional guidance that strengthens that clarity. Can you just speak to that briefly?
Yeah, I suppose there'd be two things to say on that. The first is, one of the key pieces of constitutional guidance we recommend is a statement of constitutional principles, these high-level principles that can act as a lodestar and politically, for people conducting constitutional policy, and that includes policy that between central and devolved governments. And it's interesting that this is also a recommendation from the Independent Commission for the need to have these principles here as a kind of prerequisite for having a more principled discussion and approach to constitutional affairs. I suppose the other thing, and this is something that we thought a lot about throughout the review, but ultimately didn't include in the report, as the need for better intergovernmental relations. And you've seen in the Senate and the Scottish Parliament and in the UK Parliament, there's various different reviews ongoing in different committees right now into how these mechanisms are working. And the reason we didn't put it in the report was because it was simply too soon after the establishment of the new framework to, we thought it wouldn't be fair to comment on it until enough time has passed, but I think it seems fairly clear that these mechanisms, whilst institutions are quite good, that the political will isn't there. And one interesting recommendation that's not ours, but I saw as a Hansard Society, was that perhaps we need more kind of inter-parliamentary working to have like a kind of committee that spans across Parliament to scrutinise these intergovernmental relations, which as an interest in relation to our own committee and whether that could all be done in one committee or whether these would be need to be two different things. But I thought that was a positive and interesting recommendation to explore. But yeah, it seems maddening that things continue to go to the courts.
Yeah.
In these instances without being resolved prior to that.
Yeah, and I think it does come back to intergovernmental relations. As you say, they've obviously had the Dunlop review, and that's come into fruition. I think it's been a source of frustration that has been reflected across the Independent Commission's work in Wales as well. But as you say, if we're to conceive of a United Kingdom where all nations are broadly on board, understand what their role is, also understand how they can influence if they want that to change, and whereby, how that can take place. And I think it's really, really interesting around formalizing those mechanisms, not only between governments, but also between parliaments. And I think the role of a committee seems one of the ways you could seek to bring parliamentarians and members from across the UK to have these conversations in a bit more of a kind of systemized way, rather than just, oh, you're mates with someone of the same party that happens to have an interest in constitutional change, which shouldn't be how it works. And this comes back to Brexit and how working on convention has not worked particularly well for the constitutional arrangements of the UK, and that ends up in poorer policy making for people in each of these areas. But Sue, thank you very much for your time, Steph. It's been really interesting, and I could have spoken to you for many more hours over these issues. So thank you for your time. It's been a really interesting conversation, and yeah, displays again the importance of constitutional conversations in Wales. Can't take place only in Wales, but need to engage in these wider debates that the rest of the UK is having around devolution, decentralisation, and real nitty questions around how the UK is governed really practically. And yes, that the Wales's constitutional future and conversations around that are part of a wider system that is also in need of reinvigoration, change, challenge. So if you'd like to hear more about the IWA's Constitutional Futures Project, please do check in with the IWA's Twitter account, which is at IWA_Wales, where we'll be having lots more similarly interesting questions, and also some of that work that I was talking about around the role of public engagement on policy making as well. So thanks again for your time, Steph, and thank you for listening.
Thanks, Joe.